On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. When it comes to tales of addiction, it's the high-profile stories we hear of starlets flitting in and out of rehab as though it's a weekend retreat. Lindsay Lohan and Britney Spears have made headlines for seeking treatment. Critics charge their laissez-faire approach makes a mockery of addiction, that the reality of beating drug or alcohol addiction is tough. It takes more than a stint in rehab to get on the road to recovery, and instances of relapse among anyone are a difficult part of getting over addiction. Up next, On Point, the disease of addiction and the process of recovery. Joining me now in the studio is Dr. Roger Weiss, Clinical Director of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Treatment Program at McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts. He's also Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard. Dr. Weiss, how nice to have you with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Rehab is this phrase that's sort of thrown around these days. I wonder if from a medical perspective you could define it for us. What is rehab?
Well, I'm actually not crazy about the term rehab. I think the idea of rehab came from the idea that there is this one burst of intensive treatment that is the major focus of your treatment, and that other treatments are either, quote, aftercare or take second place to that, and that the major work gets done. I'd rather think of it as a component of treatment, which ranges from hospitalization to residential treatment, which is often called rehab, outpatient treatment of various intensities, Alcoholics Anonymous, et cetera.
So it's sort of whatever your addiction may be, you have to find a program or a something that works for you and your particular case.
Absolutely. And your point that you made at the beginning of the show that this is a lifetime process is very important, that it's not a one-shot treatment and that's it. People with addiction are vulnerable to relapse to addiction for the rest of their lives, and they need to be vigilant about that over the long run, not just for a few weeks.
What are the demographics of this, Dr. Weiss? Who is seeking treatment in this country?
The demographics are all over the place. That this is addiction does not just hit one sociodemographic characteristic. All ages, men and women, all races, all religions. Anybody can be hit by addiction and can therefore seek treatment.
Is it true? I was just reading yesterday, though, that there are more women now than ever before that are seeking treatment, and younger women. Is that true?
Yeah, that is true, that there is a trend. In general, more men than women seek treatment for substance abuse problems, and that remains the case. But the gap in terms of that male versus female split has narrowed.
You didn't want to use the term rehab, but as sort of a general,
yes.
What happens in rehab, or what happens when you go get treatment for addiction?
Well, it depends on where you get treatment. I think people often think about treatment occurring in a residential treatment program. In other words, people live somewhere for
24/7.
Right, for a week to a month. What happens in those residential programs is that people get a variety of different types of treatment, a lot of group counseling, individual counseling, family counseling. They may receive medications. People often have medical disorders or psychiatric disorders that need to be diagnosed and treated as well.
And do you treat alcohol addiction differently than you would treat painkiller addiction, differently than you would treat cocaine addiction? I mean, or is it all sort of the same underlying problem?
Some similarities, some differences. The similarities is that the general goal of treatment is to stop using whatever it is that you're using. And so generally, most treatment programs recommend abstinence from all drugs of abuse plus alcohol. So to that extent, it is similar. What's different is that there are medications that can be used to help the treatment of these various disorders, and those tend to be specific to the drug of abuse that people have been using.
You mentioned that addiction is a lifelong effort. You don't just get over it. And so I'm wondering, how often do patients relapse?
That really varies with the individual. Relapse is quite common, but that doesn't... If you look, for example, at people who are trying to stop smoking cigarettes, it's typical that people try to stop several times before they're successful. That's often true with alcohol and drugs like cocaine or opiates as well. But that doesn't mean if you've relapsed, that doesn't mean that's it. You're going to stay relapsed forever. Sometimes people learn something from a relapse that helps them in long-term recovery.
Let me take a moment to introduce another guest, Dr. Weiss. Joining me now from San Diego is Dr. Martin Paulus. He's professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Diego. Doctor, nice to have you with us.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
What from your perspective, makes someone susceptible to addiction?
Well, I think there probably are a number of factors. We particularly are interested in what kind of brain processes make people vulnerable to addiction. It appears that there's probably a mixture of aspects, of factors that contribute. Emotional vulnerability is certainly one factor. The degree of impulsivity may be another one. There are probably other yet less well understood factors that are transmitted genetically, so that we're quite early at this process in identifying who may be at increased risk for addiction or for substance dependence.
Through imaging, you've actually studied the brain of addicts, and what have you found?
Well, there's a couple of things that we've found so far. First of all, and we're certainly not the only group that has been doing this, it's very clear that the brain changes are lasting beyond the time that the individual is using the substance. And there are some other groups that have shown that as much as a year later, you still see changes in critical brain areas, such as what's called the striatum, which is a part of the brain that is that is important for organizing behaviors, for how you respond to rewards and punishments. What we have done, we did a study where we looked at whether these kinds of brain images can be used to make predictions about who is at high risk for a relapse and who is not. And to quite our surprise, what we found is that the brain patterns that we do see, and that's sort of the degree to which a subject engages in a decision-making process, is quite predictive of their susceptibility to relapse.
So you can actually look at a brain scan and say, this person is going to have a relapse. They're going to have a problem down the road.
That's exactly right. And we're working currently on developing it to a degree that it's not just predictive as a group, but really predictive for an individual, so that we can say person A is at a 90% chance of relapsing, or is at least at a minimum at a very high risk of relapsing, and therefore specific interventions may need to take place to prevent that from happening.
Is the brain of an addict, I'm curious, physically different to begin with, or does the brain change with the use of a substance?
That is a very we do another series of studies with individuals who have casually used stimulants but are not yet addicted or dependent, and we find differences in the functional status of the brain, even in these individuals, which suggests to us that that the brain functioning of individuals who are at risk to using and to some degree becoming dependent on substances may already function different before addiction sets in. Mm.
Dr. Weiss, let me turn back to you and ask you how easy it is for a habit to slide into an addiction.
Well, that's a very good question. In addition to the other issues involved in addiction, there are habitual aspects of it. There are some people that really start using substances addictively right off the bat. So they get into trouble very quickly, and they never really use drugs or alcohol casually and without problems.
Is that because of the substance, or perhaps they're predisposed to it initially?
I think that tends to be people who are predisposed, because it includes alcohol as well. There are people that develop alcohol problems, severe alcohol problems, even in their teens, or in their early 20s, and they never really have a period of social non-problematic drinking. Whereas there are other people who, using alcohol as an example, may drink socially for 10, 20, 30, 40 years without any problem and slowly but surely start drinking more and more and start developing problems. I think it speaks to some extent to the heterogeneity of addiction, that you can have people that become addicted right off the bat and other people after many years.
I'd like to turn now to St. Paul, Minnesota. Wendy Burt is on the line. She's been in recovery for 22 months after battling an addiction to painkillers. Wendy, it's great to have you with us. Thanks.
Hi, thanks, Jane.
So I was reading about your story a little bit yesterday. You took your first drink at 13.
Yes.
How do you remember addiction starting for you?
Well, I remember that I really liked the feeling. So I think, right away when I tried drinking, I really liked it and spent a lot of my junior high and high school years, binge drinking and drinking on the weekends and kind of searching for, a family liquor cabinet to raid or, going to a party or something like that. So
you liked the feeling, you say. Was there a history of addiction in your family?
No, actually, I come from a really pretty normal family. My parents rarely drank, and, that was back in the day when, in the 60s, fathers would get, bottles of whiskey for Christmas and stuff, and all that stuff just sat in our basement, and my parents really rarely drank.
So you drank heavily in high school and college, occasionally alcohol,
right.
Poisoning.
Yeah, I frequently would, you hear a lot about college students and binge drinking, and I certainly did that, and, would drink so much to the point of getting alcohol poisoning and, be sick for 2 days after it, and then I'd kind of say, wow, I need to not do that again, and then, a few months later or a year later, I'd do it again, and really, I thought this was kind of normal, especially in college, and really only once did someone tell me, the campus doctor my freshman year of college told me, you might have a drinking problem. And I thought that was crazy because I was a freshman in college. This is what you do. And but over the years, I really tried to kind of moderate my drinking because it didn't agree with me. And
then you got a root canal and they gave you painkillers.
And then I had some things like root canals and migraines. And whenever I got the Tylenol 3 or a Vicodin or something like that, I just loved it. I thought that was terrific. And, I'd hoard them and then I'd take them later. And I kind of, found that if I took them when I was stressed out, that made me feel pretty good. And I thought, well, why would you drink if you could take one of these? Why have a cocktail when you can take a couple of Vicodin?
So how often were you taking them and were you doubling up?
Yeah, I mean, that, it started kind of occasionally I would take them. And then, I'd take them for a headache. And then because I did have some pretty bad migraines for a while. And I'd take them for a headache. And then I'd start taking them because I thought maybe I might get a headache. And then I'd take them because I thought I might get stressed and might get a headache. And then eventually, around 2002, 2003, I just kept taking more of them. And
what was life like during that time, popping so many pills every day, when it becomes everything you think about?
It's everything you think about, exactly. It becomes an obsession, and everything is second to how many pills I have, how many I can take today, how long they're going to last, when I can get some more. And, and I would get up and I'd go to work and take them during work and think that I was, functioning okay at work.
Were you?
I don't know. It always you feel like you're functioning, but in reality, I think, you know, I would have to say it, I'm sure it affected my work in not such a great way.
And how long were you addicted to Vicodin before you realized you needed help?
Well, probably 2 or 3 years. And it just got to the point where I was so physically uncomfortable, and I knew I was physically addicted. It just became so hard to keep trying to figure out how I was going to get more, and, you know, any amount of withdrawal was so uncomfortable. So I finally, unlike a lot of people, I didn't have an intervention, you know, nobody sat me down. My family, my parents didn't know, my friends didn't know, nobody really sat me down and talked to me. I just was like, I can't keep doing this, and, you know, called the insurance company and said, I think I have a drug problem, I need to get some help. And
checked yourself in.
And I started in an outpatient program, and that, I really couldn't stop using. And I started going to a 12-step program, and I finally, after kind of trying to do that for about 2 months, I decided this is just, it's too hard, and it's really hard to stop. And I decided I really needed to focus on this. I really needed help, and then I checked myself into Hazelden in August of 2004.
And after that period of treatment, you were fine. Your story continues, however. You broke your ankle.
Yeah, I had a really great experience in treatment, and I was there for 32 days, and it enabled me to really focus on, you know, understanding the disease. They educate you about the disease. You know, you start working a 12-step program. You know, you find out you're very similar to the other people who are there. And I went back home, and I felt like I was doing really pretty well, and I was, you know, doing what I was supposed to be doing. I was going to meetings, and I had a sponsor, and I was spending a lot of time with other people who were also in recovery. And then I broke my ankle, as you mentioned, and I broke it really severely, and I tried to fight the idea of getting painkillers at the hospital, and the doctors said that they had to give me painkillers, and I got a taste of it again.
And you liked it.
That was really a dangerous situation. Mm. And, you know, I went home with painkillers, and I took more than I was supposed to, and I took them longer than I was supposed to, and that led to about 6 months of kind of on again, off again with them. And so, yeah, I have experienced relapse, and it's, you know, I sure don't recommend it. It's really hard to go through that again. And
you've been clean now for 22 months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you have feel really good.
You have a good job as a public relations consultant, and
right,
you're obviously very open about your addiction. Has that been part of the recovery for you?
For me, yeah, I have been pretty open about it with people, and I just feel like, you know, addiction can happen to anybody. There's still great misunderstanding about it and lack of knowledge about it. And I think if people realize it can happen to anybody, it's not just some, you know, poor homeless person on the street. It can happen to anybody, professionals and people in business. And if we can be open about it, hopefully that'll reduce the stigma of addiction and alcoholism. Mm. So,
Wendy, thank you. Dr. Weiss, what is the stigma attached to this, to addiction?
Well, I think that it is a problem that people are very reluctant to admit because they feel that they'll be ostracized and that people will think badly of them. And so I think that's one of the things that actually gets in the way of people seeking help. So they try to deal with it on their own, often for a much longer time than they should, and the problem can get worse and worse. I think that in Wendy's situation, the good news is that she got some very good treatment and is doing very well in her recovery. But even as motivated as she was and as hard as she's worked, she had a relapse, and I think that's very common.
Dr. Paulus, it's not a failure, is it? I think that's what a lot of people think of. You go in and out of rehab and you try to kick it and boy, you just can't. And it's not that you failed. It's just that it's really hard.
No, not at all. I think that, and again, what Dr. Weiss said is very accurate. It's relapse is part of the process of addiction or dependence. And what we begin to understand what the brain does, it forms a very, very powerful representation of these drugs. And anything that can reactivate that representation will often reactivate the urge and the drive and the motivation to seek out these drugs. Mm-hmm. So even though you may do fine for periods of time, because you're not exposed to the stimuli that reactivate these experiences, once you are exposed, you are at an extremely high risk for relapse, which is sounds like what happened in this case.
Many callers are waiting to join the conversation. I want to start with George, who's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. George, hi, you're on the line.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Over 20 years ago, my best friend was an active alcoholic. And in order for me to understand the situation, I started studying something about it. And the most helpful books that I found were from Ann Wilson Schaaf, When Society Becomes an Addict and the Addictive Organization. And this study led me to believe that we live in an addictive society, that we use addictive thought processes. So, for instance, today, advertisers and public relations people in the corporate world talk about corporate branding almost as if it's an addictive process, where it's not the goods and services, but the name that gives people value, the brand itself, that we think and react addictively. Everything is a crisis. There's only black and white. A false perfectionism, so that if one little thing goes wrong, everything is wrong, and that's an excuse to drink.
So it's a cultural issue. George, thank you for your thoughts. Steve is calling from Freeport, Florida. Steve, hi, you're on the line.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The previous caller was going in a direction that I was kind of thinking myself also, and the fact that, from my perspective, you know, we are all addicted to something. It's just, is it a vice? Is it positive? Is it negative? And then we focus on the detriments that come from the drug abuse, the alcohol abuse, when we're all addicted to something. My question would be to the doctor from California, you know, when you study the brain and the results of the addiction, I don't know, I'm curious as to whether it be caused, you know, from some kind of enlargement because of the drug abuse or just the compulsive nature that would maybe expand that part of the brain, or is it physically possible for that to happen? Coming out of younger life of drugs and drug dealing and use of drugs, and I was addicted to gambling. I was a compulsive gambler. And then, you know, walking away from all that, you know, some 20 years ago, you know, there was a tremendous spiritual aspect in my ability to overcome those things. I was able to replace the addiction with something that was, you know, greater to me.
And church?
In the church, mm-hmm. Exactly. And I found that when we talk about rehab, you know, what are we rehabbing people back to? You know, we're taking them back to a place right before they got addicted. So where do they go from there? Okay, now you're fresh, now you're clean, enjoy yourself once more. Mm-hmm. I mean, until we take them on a different direction, you know, and occupy their time, you know, which it seems to me most addicts have a lot of time and they have the means to take themselves to a self-approved place of excitement within their brain.
Steve, I'm going to cut you off and I'm going to let Dr. Paulus answer your question. Go ahead, Dr. Paulus.
Okay. I heard sort of two issues here. The first has to do with the potentially societal influences on drug addiction, drug dependence. And we find this in our studies of individuals who are casually using, who are in the age range between 18 and 24. One thing we have to recognize is that the onsets of addictions are usually in adolescence, young adulthood. Hmm. And those are very specific times in individuals' lives that are very strongly determined by their surroundings. Hmm. And what we found in conducting in-depth clinical interviews, that performance is a very important aspect here. That individuals take substances for a purpose, and the purpose that we find repeatedly is either, say, to become more gregarious at a party or to become better studiers, to be able to pass tests and get higher grades. So there is that element to it. The other point that came up is, are there similarities across different types of addictions? And I think we're just beginning to really study this from a brain perspective. There certainly is some evidence that, for example, the caller mentioned gambling addiction has very many similarities with other forms of addiction. So that the process, and I think that this was described very nicely earlier on, this obsession, this repetitiveness, the all-encompassing experience of only thinking of one thing and only acting and making decisions towards that one thing is a very, very central characteristic of addiction, and not just of substance addictions, but also of gambling addictions and other forms of addiction.
Let me turn to Dr. Weiss for a moment, because the caller actually brings up a point in my mind. He said that he overcame his addiction partly by turning to his church, and I wonder if you can conquer addiction with faith, Dr. Weiss. Is professional intervention always necessary?
Professional intervention is not always necessary. Many people do stop using drugs or alcohol on their own. That said, if people are physically dependent on drugs or alcohol, then stopping on your own can be medically dangerous, and I would never advise that. But there are people who drink too much or use drugs occasionally who one day wake up and say, I think I've had enough. I think if anybody had any question about the safety of that, they should check with a physician. But but there are many people that do stop on their own, or they go to Alcoholics Anonymous or groups like that, which are not professional groups, but they are mutual help groups.
My guests today are Dr. Roger Weiss of McLean Hospital and Harvard University, and Dr. Martin Paulus of UC San Diego. I'm also speaking with Wendy Burt, who is in recovery. And Wendy, before I let you go, I must ask you how much you've had to remove yourself from situations in your life, sort of environmental links to your past, situations where you know you're going to get into trouble. How effective has that been in your treatment and in your recovery?
Well, that's an important point for a lot of people in recovery. For me, you know, I really kind of, my drug use was at home alone, basically. And so it wasn't like I was going to the bar every night or anything like that. And so while I haven't really had to change anything environmentally, I didn't have to, you know, stop seeing using friends or anything like that or going to certain places. But I did change my life in terms of the people that I spend a lot of time with. I spent a lot of time with other people in recovery, and that kind of relates to what the last caller was talking about, too. I just think the benefit for me in recovery has been being with a lot of other people who are in recovery. I think that trying to do it yourself didn't work for me. And being with people who understand where you've come from, I think, is a big help to people who are trying to get sober.
Well, Wendy Burt, I wish you the best moving forward. Take care, and thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Dr. Paulus, University of California, San Diego, Wendy mentioned this notion of support. And I guess if you're not an addict, it's hard to understand what those cravings mean. And I read a piece where you use the example of trying to lose weight as it relates to an addiction. Could you share that with us?
Yeah, so one of the issues that is sometimes hard for people who have not had direct contact with people who were addicted or who have not had experience with addiction themselves, it's hard to understand is the degree of urge and drive that it really occurs when you are starting to think about drugs and when that gets reactivated in the brain. But a good example is people trying to lose weight, and the process then starting to bring this really to the forefront that you're trying to not eat. But the process of thinking about not eating is exactly what makes you possibly more hungry and increase the urge to want to eat. So there is this real issue that the moment you bring it into focus on of your attention, it becomes something that becomes all-encompassing. Mm-hmm. And we do need to remind ourselves again how difficult the process is of trying to lose weight permanently and how many challenges we find in that process. And we can then only begin to understand how difficult it is for somebody who is dependent or addicted to a substance as strong as, say, the opioids or the stimulants or also alcohol, for that matter.
Back to the phones. I'd like to invite Chris from North Kingstown, Rhode Island, to join our conversation. Hi, Chris. You're on the line.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine, thank you.
I'm 19 years old, and I'm in recovery. I'm a heroin addict, and I started off doing OxyContin, and it eventually turned into a heroin addiction. I went to rehab for 6 months and got out, and I moved away from my house in Connecticut. I moved to Rhode Island, and I was clean for another 6 months, but I went home to visit, and I relapsed the day I went home, and now I'm on methadone, and that's going well for me. And I wanted to see what the doctors felt about methadone, and if they think it's a good option for heroin addicts to do.
Chris, thanks so much for your call. Yeah. Dr. Weiss?
Oh, methadone is an option for many people who are dependent on heroin. I think that
first of all, tell us what it does. What is it?
Yes, methadone is a medication. It's an opiate medication that's a long-acting medication, so that when people have been addicted typically to heroin and are unable to stop, and often people have tried to stop and they are at great risk, particularly if people are using needles, they're at great risk of hepatitis C, HIV, AIDS, all kinds of infections, overdoses, et cetera, some people then seek a maintenance treatment, either methadone or another medication called buprenorphine, that satisfies the craving for opiates but allows people to continue functioning.
What about this maintenance treatment for things like methamphetamines, which have just exploded in their use in this country?
There are no maintenance treatments for methamphetamine or cocaine that are similar to methadone or buprenorphine. Mm-hmm. There's actually no medications that have been found to be reliably effective for either of those drugs of abuse, although intensive research is going on to try to find an effective medication.
Dr. Paulus, what is the effect of a methamphetamine on the brain?
Well, methamphetamine, similar to cocaine and amphetamine, works primarily by releasing a chemical called dopamine. Dopamine is a very important neurochemical in the brain because it is associated with probably two main processes. First, it helps individuals to learn what are important things in their environment. And the second, it is helpful in mediating the positive feeling that is associated with the occurrence of those stimuli.
Is that why it's so particularly addictive, methamphetamine?
That's exactly it. There's a couple of specific things about methamphetamine. It is, it's easy to produce. It is becoming incredibly widely available, and it has a very fast onset time. That's something that came up a little earlier. Is that, for example, as opposed to methadone or some of the substitute treatments, which are long-acting, many of the highly addictive substances are very short-acting and flood the system very quickly. And some researchers have proposed that it is directly related to the potency of the addictive potency is directly related to how fast these substances come on to the brain.
Mm. Back to the phones. Reed is calling from Lubbock, Texas. Reed, hi, you're on the line.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to mention, for me personally, I've been sober since August 2003. I got sober when I was 19, and I was a methamphetamine user intravenously. And I don't know, for me, going to a halfway house really, really helped.
How so? Also, why was it so effective?
You know, I just think that I really, like, when I got sober, I was 19, and I don't think I was really ready. Like, I had an intervention done, and, you know, I was pretty much on rock bottom, but I didn't want to quit. And, you know, intervention was done. I went to rehab, but then when I went to the halfway house, I got to, you know, develop such a big support system and that kind of stuff, and it just really, really helped me.
Reed, thanks for your call. Good luck to you. Dr. Weiss, is it true that the majority of rehab programs used in halfway houses and other places, it's the 12-step model that was essentially created back in the 1930s, right? Still effective today?
It is actually the predominant model in a lot of treatment programs. A lot of residential treatment programs use what's called the so-called Minnesota model. Because there were a lot of treatment programs early on in Minnesota, and they used a model that was very much fashioned after the 12-step philosophy of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's been an evolution over time so that there are a number of different approaches to the treatment of addiction for which there is good research evidence that they are effective. Some of them focus on the kinds of thinking patterns people have that use medication. Some are family issues, family approaches, approaches to build up motivation. So it's not all 12-step work, but that in conjunction with other approaches.
Mm. Mike is calling now from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Mike, hi, you're on the line.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
Sure.
I actually attended treatment at McLean Hospital. I'm from Montana. My problem started with two DUIs. I had a binge right after the war started. Actually, I went to AA for a while. I went to treatment in Montana for a while. I attended the AA groups. And what I found was very hard for me was the first step when they say I'm powerless over alcohol. Hmm. I could not really get into it. I also have bipolar disorder, so I'm co-occurring. And there's a whole issue involved in that, neuroscientifically. However, I find that now that I haven't drank in 4 years or used any other drugs, that I can't look at it as I'm powerless. I must look at it that I have power in order to feel empowered, in order to have self-esteem, in order to accomplish what I'm doing, because I'm going to be a counselor myself, an LMHC, mental health counselor. And so it's really important for me to work with clients in any way they need to, because I do believe support is crucial in any way, 12-step, you know, self-help groups of different kinds, like the Minnesota model. There's other groups out there that can be very effective. Mm. However, for me, it was finding friends. I had to give up my friends. And once I did, I found it easier to stop alcohol because I was a social drinker. Mm. I actually flipped my truck and I lived through it somehow. I went through the justice system. I lost my license. You know, I couldn't drive for a year. Therefore, I lost my job. Somehow I made it back. But for a lot of people, especially people that are poor, I'm not exactly what I call poor. I have family support. It's an ongoing dilemma, mm-hmm. and there's not help out there. Right. And it's mm-hmm. kind of a miracle, I think, sometimes when people that go to NA and AA in a culture, especially like Montana, when Time Magazine said it's the crank capital of the United States, to actually somehow get better. You know?
Well, good luck to you, Mike. I appreciate your call, and take care. I want to go back to the phones to Kingsborough, Massachusetts, where Susan is on the line. Hi, Susan. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a med-surg nurse, And we see patients, they'll be admitted for anything, having a total hip done, but we also have to be watching people for, they get admitted to the hospital, 3 days later they can actually have, some, you know, their withdrawal from alcohol, but they've never told us that they even drank. So I'm not a psych nurse, but I find it hard looking at the spectrum, and not that we'll be diagnosing them on the med-surg floor, but when people start to ask us, oh, I take 1 to 2 drinks a day, but I'm really not an alcoholic, I find that the scale that we have to look at for them relates their alcoholism, or calling them an alcoholic, to their social functioning, which we really can't gauge. So I have a hard time finding my way through that, even as a nurse.
Let me, Susan, thank you for your call. Let me turn to Dr. Weiss and ask you about that. How do you know if you have a problem?
Well, I think the essence of having an alcohol problem or a drug problem is that the drinking actually either causes problems in your life or is threatening to cause problems in your life. And very often that you find that you've thought about cutting back or stopping and you've tried and it hasn't worked out. You find yourself drinking more than you intend to, and that it's becoming an increasingly important part of your life. You may, in some instances, but not all instances, you may find that you need to drink more than you used to in order to get the same effect, or you may find that it's hard to, that you feel shaky when you wake up in the morning, but usually it's really related to that drinking is starting to cause some problems in your life, and you find that you keep drinking anyway.
And after treatment is finished, how do you know that a patient is ready to leave? How do you know that they've sort of made it over the hump, if you will?
Well, when you say after treatment is finished, there's really just different phases of treatment. So someone may be ready to leave a residential treatment program when they've got a decent living situation and when they've got a good ongoing treatment plan in place. The bigger question of when does somebody leave outpatient treatment? Well, if somebody's got a good AA system in place, then they're going to be in better position than somebody that really doesn't have that kind of support. So usually it's having support at the next level that makes you feel optimistic about somebody leaving a particular level.
Dr. Martin Paulus, before our hour is up here, I just want to ask you about the future of what you do, and that is study brain imaging as it relates to addiction. Is there going to be a time where we sort of see a breakthrough in this area? What's your sense?
Well, I think that possibly are several important developments that we may think of as breakthroughs. First, and I think Dr. Weiss again also highlighted this, there's an incredible amount of research going on in trying to develop medication treatments for some of these addictions, because as was pointed out, there are no medication treatments for stimulant addictions of any kind, cocaine, methamphetamine, amphetamine, or prescription stimulants. And that is a very, very important problem. But the second thing is, I think, you know, in psychiatry, we rely on what the people tell us. And it is very, very obvious that people who are addicted have most of them make an incredibly strong effort and a good faith effort to try to stay sober. But the problem is that the brain may have other things in mind that cannot even be verbalized at that point. Mm. So if we were able to directly basically inquire what the status of the brain is, not through self-report, not through what the person is saying, but through other means by directly taking brain images, and then tell the person, listen, you're telling us you try to stay sober, but your brain tells us otherwise, I think that would be a major advance.
Interesting. Fascinating. Dr. Martin Paulus, professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Diego. Thanks so much for your time, Dr. Paulus.
Thank you.
And Dr. Roger Weiss, clinical director of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Treatment Program at McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts, also professor of psychiatry at Harvard. Dr. Weiss, thanks so much to you as well.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.